Hello and welcome back to Theatre Voice. I'm Matt Truman and this is our final episode of the year and indeed of this series. If you've made it this far, thanks for listening. If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find every episode on our website theatrevoice.com or by subscribing to our feed on iTunes. But who better to wrap up the year than the playwright James Graham? As the critic Dominic Cavendish says in this bumper edition, he's had quite the 2017. Two new plays in the West End, Ink and Labour of Love, and another quiz coming into town next year after a successful run at the Chichester Festival Theatre. Graham's often talked of as a political writer, and rightly so. He's gradually working through our national institutions, Parliament, the press, party politics, like some kind of millennial David Hare. But that description doesn't tell the whole story. It manages to overlook the fun Graham has with form. His account of the rise of Rupert Murdoch's Sun, Inc. turned tabloid tactics back on the tabloid press, telling a story that might just be too good to be true. Labour of Love, which charts the Labour Party's bungee to Blairism and back, toys with time, running political history backwards and then forwards again in the second half. Quiz, meanwhile, about the coughing major that cheated Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, well, that asks the audience. We'll be back in the new year, sometime around mid-March, but in the meantime, playing us out, here's Dominic Cavendish talking to the brilliant James Graham.
Anyone trying to tell the story of British theatre in 2017 is going to have to make significant reference to one name in particular. Yes, of course, one of the plays of the year has been Jez Butterworth's The Ferryman, and a strong case can be made too for the importance of Mike Bartlett's Albion. But it seems to me incontestable that were theatre to have the equivalent of Time magazine's Person of the Year, it would have to place James Graham on the front cover. The succession of Ink at the Almeida, transferring to the Duke of York's, Labour of Love, opening straight into the West End at the Noel Coward, and subsequently Quiz, which opened at Chichester last month and comes into land at the Noel Coward 2 next April, puts this Nottinghamshire-born playwright in a league of his own. Reviewers like myself are probably guilty of overusing words like wunderkind and man of the moment, and I suppose being in your mid-30s disqualifies you sooner or later from being a bright young thing. But this has been the most extraordinary burst of successful playwriting, combining productivity and perspicacity, historical research with an on-the-button sense of the here and now I think I've ever seen. James Graham, welcome. I just wonder whether, firstly, there have been times during 2017 when you've sort of had to pinch yourself, because, I mean, this is a pretty unprecedented slew of successful plays. What's it been like?
I always wish I could come up with an answer to that, and I haven't been able to. I mean, honestly, I feel all the usual platitudes. I feel really lucky and really grateful, and it's never one person who can achieve getting a production on or getting a show on. So, you know, whether it's the Almeida or Sonia Freeman moving Ink, or Headlong and Michael Grandage taking a huge, huge punt on putting Labour of Love straight into the West End. And then, you know, just the coincidence of them being in two theatres next door to each other. I think the gesture of that makes it look like a grander achievement than it probably is. It's just a huge coincidence. But no, I mean, the one moment when I did sort of get the scale of it was my family, who aren't theatre people or arty people, when my mum came down to the press night of Labour of Love, and that she saw the two theatres next to each other, and then yes, we did spend about 12 minutes trying to find the best place to take a selfie on St Martin's Lane. But I know that she was very proud, and that reminded me of you know where we had come from and how long it had been to get here. I just feel really, really lucky and grateful that especially at this politically interesting time where there is so much politics going on in this country and around the world, to have found myself at a point in my writing life where I'm very lucky to be given stages and where audiences want to come and see political work in the mainstream. It just feels like a really great opportunity. Well, I think the good thing about having the plays on, and as anyone who directs or writes or acts in a play knows, it's so furiously busy when you're doing it in tech and rewriting all the way through previews and all the stuff that comes with opening a new show, that actually you don't really get a huge amount of time to step back and look at it. So thankfully, my feet were kept on the ground by the fact that I had to spend most of my time in front of my laptop on the floor of the Noel Coward rewriting the play.
Did it suddenly seem like you were dashing from one space to the next?
There were a few moments where someone would have seen me flapping up and down St Martin's Lane with a salad in my hand between texts and dresses. But you know, that's a nice problem to have. I'm not complaining. Yeah. But with Labour of Love, because we wanted it to be completely up to date, and the Labour conference actually was happening the week of the opening of Labour of Love, that we wanted to get some of those themes and ideas into the play. So yeah, we were rewriting right up until opening night. The joy of quiz was it's a slightly weird one. It's not on paper the most obvious format for either a political analysis or a mainstream audience. It's a story about a guy who cheated on a game show 16 years ago. So I felt the freedom. I felt the freedom of working with Daniel in a smaller studio space in Chichester to do something a little different, a little weirder. It's an interactive show. We have to interact with the audience, and that requires a lot of technical supports. And we didn't quite necessarily know what it was going to be when we opened or how things were going to work. So I felt the freedom of that. I didn't for a second feel any commercial pressures to get something slick and finished and polished out of the gates for a West End transfer. I just wanted to nail the Chichester show. So when the call came about 5 days later after we opened that it was going to move and also move to the Noel Coward, where I was also in for Labour of Love, that feeling doesn't diminish. I don't roll my eyes and go, okay, fine, another one. I still get the buzz and the fizz and the excitement of knowing that people are going to trust it and support it and believe that it can get an audience in town.
Is there almost a James Graham audience now?
I have no idea. I wouldn't presume to think that's the case. And we had this conversation when it was announced that Ink was going to move onto St Martin's Lane next door to Labour of Love. And of course there were a few, I don't think both producers would mind me saying, there were a couple of intense conversations about whether or not one would take the audience away from the other. And there's only so many plays by one author that an audience can tolerate in any one season. And I don't know the answer to that. But the truth is, I would love to flatter myself that people book tickets to see plays exclusively by the writer, but I don't think that's true in the West End. I think people want to see a play about a certain subject matter, or that they want to see certain actors. I think there's a whole package that makes people decide whether or not they're going to trust a show or not. And I think on each occasion, as a playwright, you have to prove your play on each time. I don't think you can just assume that people are going to come. What I think is exciting about certainly the West End at the moment is that there's a huge appetite for new plays, and new plays that have a social and political conscience, whether it's The Ferryman, whether it's Oslo. Looking further afield, you know, Mosquitoes by Lucy Kirkwood. One of my favourite plays of the year at the Royal Court was Anatomy of a Suicide. I thought the bravery of that subject matter that Alice tackled, and the imaginative way that she did that. I think we're in such a good place for new writing that can find a mainstream popular audience that doesn't exclude an audience, but that is really brave and really bold and ask really difficult social, emotional, political questions.
Mm. With Labour of Love, you've written a piece that's absolutely up to the minute. I don't think I've seen a play that's more has a stronger sense of trying to wrap in almost the daily news in effect. You know, what's happening, what people are talking about in the street. Can I ask, I suppose, boldly, what was the play that we saw at the Noel Coward in effect pretty much the play that you set out to write, or did that general election result really sort of rather radically transform your perception of what you wanted to say, I suppose?
I think the general election result radically changed the central question that the play was asking. I actually began writing Labour of Love. I first conceived of it when Labour first lost power in 2010, so that's now 7 years ago. That's why I almost feel like I can't take that's what I mean, I think, by the coincidence of these plays happening and converging all at one moment, because sometimes you have to set these balls rolling so far down the line that you can't predict that they're all going to arrive at the destination at the same time. So I first started conceiving Labour of Love when Labour had been kicked out of power, and I was observing it going through the same sort of existential crisis cycle that it normally does when it loses power. But it took, either it was me that was going slowly or the Labour Party was going slowly, but it took a while, I think, for it to find its real purpose and for me to nail what I wanted to say about this party, this movement. And I'm so relieved. There were moments throughout the past 5 years when we could have, I think, got it together and put it on. But there's something about where the Labour Party is right now that it's at its most interesting crossroads, and it's at its most confusing, because everything about what happened in that general election this year contradicts normal political science and the normal cycle of things. And so it's the most exciting time, I hope, to be asking questions about this party's past and its future. In my particular case, growing up in a mining community in Nottinghamshire that booked the national trend entirely, there's a huge swing to the Tories in these seats, and in fact many seats around mine went Conservative, even though nationally Labour gained seats. So I was setting the play by complete accident in an anomaly. It was a complete anomaly. It wasn't representing the national picture. But again, that felt really exciting to be basing a play in a place that was totally against the national trend. And I felt that meant that it could ask a bigger question about what was going on and what was happening in that party in this country.
There's a great line from Jean, played by Tamsin Gregg, in the production, who's the kind of MP's, Labour MP's, constituency office, what would you say, manager, I suppose, in a way.
Or, yeah, constituency agent.
Agent, sorry, yes. And she comes out with one of the many very pithy and amusing lines. Basically, it's a swingers party, she says, reacting to the 2017 election. I don't know who's sticking what where anymore, except that the whole thing looks more fucked than a Bradford hen do. Some of those lines, were they almost, in a sense, exasperated indications of your own confusion as you tried to digest what was happening?
No, very much so. And and for the reasons I just said, that nothing really made sense about what was happening in my community based on what was happening nationally in terms of the swing against Corbyn's Labour Party. So yes, but I mean, really, that stuff, you can rewrite that stuff. I had the time to rewrite the basics. So I knew the first opening scene and then the final scene, because it travels backwards and then forwards again, was going to be set on the eve of the election this year. So a lot of that stuff is just detail, really. Changing it from 2015 to 2017 is manageable in the time that I had before we went into rehearsal. In a way, what the harder thing to do was change the proposition of the play. Why was the play going on? If it had gone on 12 months ago, when everyone was assuming that Labour was going to crash and burn and it was going to have another reset button and change and probably move to the centre, that play would have been very different. But because something so extraordinary happened in that general election that contradicted everybody's view of the direction of travel, I feel like something more subtle had to happen throughout the entire play. It wasn't just rewriting that one scene. It was about the very premise of the play asking a different question about where we are as a party and where we are as a country. The question of the play was always going to be what is the Labour Party for and who is it for? And as we saw in this general election, there was a huge surge in young people and the gain of places like Battersea and Kensington and university towns and the middle classes. And that's great and that's incredible, because Labour was always meant to be a broad church and it needs support across the spectrum. But in places like, yes, exactly, in industrial former mining communities, we have to ask why those people who traditionally the Labour Party was supported by and people who the Labour Party was for in terms of helping, why they're moving away. And Brexit has just destroyed what was normally a reasonably simple left-right spectrum, Labour-Tory spectrum. It's thrown it all into the mix. And I suppose I never wanted the play to rain on the parade of what was happening nationally about for Labour or even Jeremy Corbyn's policies. I never really wanted to, as usual, go too far one way or the other. I just wanted to ask the questions and give both sides an equal hearing. But it's a conversation I wasn't hearing enough in the Labour Party about how you get these people back and why they're leaving. And I think mathematically, I could be completely wrong, but I think mathematically, if the Labour Party wants to get into power and be in government, it needs those people back. And so you need to ask those questions. And if no one's asking them, then I think there is a complacency, or at least a perception of the national picture that actually doesn't match reality.
At the moment, it seems as though not only are we politicised, but we're quite polarised, or becoming quite polarised. So, for example, a play written 12 months ago about the fortunes of the Labour Party, which took an even-handed view about, I suppose, the kind of Corbynite renaissance or resurgence or whatever you call it, would probably have been met with a fairly sort of, you know, sceptical, neutral right. response. But now, of course, it's pitched into a very hot debate, really, about the soul of the Labour Party and the soul of Britain in some respect. So do you feel more as though you're sort of dancing on along a sort of precipice in terms of trying not, you know, not to take sides, as it were?
I think, yes, I think that's one of the anxieties I think I'm most afraid of, to be honest, is the divisions and the factions and the tribal nature of politics and political discourse in this country, which I think has become incredibly unhealthy and toxic, probably since the referendum, but maybe it's been leading up to this point for a while. And, you know, these are all clichés that people probably get very bored of in terms of the filter bubble and how social media is algorithmically placing us into bubbles, and where we're becoming more intolerant of other people's views, or we don't even see other people's views because they don't appear in front of us. But I think there is a truth to that, I really do. And I think, even within the Labour Party, even within a movement, as you are aware, there are these factions which are often more aggressive and more intolerant of each other than even Labour versus Conservative or Labour versus UKIP. And I get why, I get the passions and I get the belief and I get the integrity of saying, well, this is what I believe and this is why I believe it. But for me, that's the most exciting responsibility of theatre in an age of social media, in an age of Twitter, or in an age of comment threads on news articles that are just explosions and bursts of anger and of people not talking to each other. Theatre, for me, provides one of the last refuges of reasonable conversation, because it forces you into a reasonable mindset when you go into a dark space and you're physically with a community of people, hopefully a great range of a mix of diverse ages and genders and race and backgrounds, ideally. I know that's often hard to achieve, but something about that experience. Did you read that? There was an incredible article a couple of weeks ago that study that said that when we assemble together in a theatre, in a physical space, our heartbeats start to match each other's. Oh, there's definitely some science, I'll look it up, but it's like something happens when you assemble physically as a people. And I think the space and that a play gives you, two and a half hours sometimes, 3 hours in my case, it just gives you that space to have nuance and to live in the grey area and to unlock these the tribal mentality that we all have, that I have, and I find myself sitting back in sometimes. And I think that's the job of plays. And I'm aware that there are probably perceptions of my stuff that it's sitting on the fence or that it lacks teeth because of this desire to be even-handedness or to not plant my flag in one side or the other. And I've always just tried to resist it because I really believe that that's the most exciting theatre, that's the most exciting drama, that gives all sides an equal hearing, and that embraces how complicated and complex these arguments are.
I suppose what's striking is that not only, again, as with this house, do we learn something about mechanics of politics at grassroots level in Labour of Love, but again, you know, you create a through line of argument about what's happened to Labour over, you know, really, really since the resignation of Margaret Thatcher. So that seems to be kind of educational tool in that.
What excites me as a writer is I've realised that it's often the institutions and systems and processes that form the basis of some of my stuff. And I, for whatever reason, understanding those processes, whether it's how does a constituency office run, and I agree, I realised when I started researching Labour of Love, I had no idea what happened in an MP's office. I had no idea the hierarchy or the structures of how a local party works with a local council, works with an MP. And given that that's the backbone of British politics, that felt really important. So yeah, I do enjoy the geekery of that. I enjoy about learning that, and I do enjoy setting out the facts and showing those systems working, or a polling station in the vote, or the Whip's office in this house. For me, there's just something about understanding the minutiae and the detail of those systems. It helps you sort of then look at the bigger stuff, the bigger political and ideological stuff through those small, strange back doors of politics or systems or institutions. I sometimes have to protect myself from overwhelming the play with too much yes, too much information, too much research, or trying too hard, really, in a kind of tarty way, to make too many contemporary urgent nods to what's happening now. I try and step back a bit more than that and do something broader about the Labour Party, or whether, or journalism on Fleet Street, or entertainment and quiz shows. And that's why I really rely and fall back on, and I've been so lucky with the directors I've worked with, who across the board have been great dramaturgical support. So whether it's Rupert Gould with Ink, or Jeremy Herring with Labour of Love, and this house, and Daniel Evans with Quiz. It's for me, writing is a collaborative process. That's why I love it. That's why I do theatre. That's why I prefer, even though I do enjoy writing screenplays and TV shows, there's nothing quite like building a play, which is a completely ensemble act. And generally speaking, I think I walk into most rehearsal rooms on day one with only about 70% of a play. And even though that probably sounds lazy or for me, it's deliberate. I leave gaps for the company, for the directors to fill, for me to be able to discover things in the room and discover things in previews. And so I enjoy that process of devising and rewriting in a room. But within that, I feel like I get the protection and support I need with someone else's perspective to say that it's too much, you're overwhelming this play with too much research or evidence.
Yeah. Did that connect with audiences, and did it ring true for the politicians who came to see it, did you find?
I think so, yeah. We were very lucky again. It was great to have the support of MPs who, in a kind of busman's holiday way, obviously always enjoy coming and seeing their jobs and their lives on stage. And I remember people like Sadiq Khan came along, and Neil Kinnock, I think Tom Watson, so past and present, Harriet Harman, Tracy Brabin, Gloria Di Piero, who's my MP in Ashfield, and she was the one who allowed me access to her constituency office and her amazing team who helped out with the research. She came along with all the gang, and I think they complimented the accuracy of the office in the world. And you know, that, a lot of that's not me. That's the design work, or the you know, the great performances, particularly from Martin Freeman and Tamsin Gregg, who did their own research on how these worlds function and these worlds work. But yeah, it just gives me a satisfaction to whenever, whether it's politicians coming to see Labour of Love, or journalists coming to see Ink, you do want those worlds to merge. You do want to have a conversation with the worlds that you're trying to represent and dramatise on stage. And actually, in the opening performances of Ink at the Almeida, we deliberately invited a lot of journalists from the Time to come and see it, and they fed in directly to me some inaccuracies, some technological or technical things that needed correcting, and the next day we would rewrite those, feed that language back into the play, and just make sure we were trying to get it as accurate as possible.
Yes, well, I suppose we will now turn to Ink, actually, although one could actually happily carry on talking about Labour of Love, but what was the initial point for you of finding out, you know, where the subject matter lay? Was there a sort of interest in The Sun per se, or Murdoch per se, or Fleet Street, I suppose?
Yes, I was really interested in journalism and particularly how the language of journalism and news has been changing over the past couple of years, whether that be, again, the nature of social media and how a kind of more bombastic form of news, whether it's Fox News or whether it's the way that the referendum was reported, the way that our language is changing, and how we're spreading news is changing in a way that I feel was making me anxious and uncomfortable. I wanted to go back and do an origin story of the birth of that kind of populist language, and so to look at the birth of The Sun under Murdoch made total sense to me. I'd also, it'd been in my brain for a couple of years, because I'd heard a lot of stories about this little civil war on Fleet Street, particularly between The Sun and The Mirror when the Sun launched. And I suppose with this house, I find if you're going to look at an institution or a profession or a world, the best time to do that is when it's under its most stress, or when it's getting to a crossroads about the direction of travel. So with this house, I guess the late 1970s, as the post-war consensus was ending, and we had to make a decision as a nation about where we were going to go. Then that building, Westminster, struggling under that under the strain of that, felt like a good way of looking at parliamentary democracy. I think I applied the same rule to In Ink and looking at Fleet Street, which felt like 1969 and the arrival of Murdoch and the change in Fleet Street, whether it be a cultural change or a change in how newspapers were being run, it felt like a crossroads. So it was an origin story for the end of one world and the beginning of a new world. It felt really exciting.
And so there's a kind of nostalgia, I suppose, about the play, certainly as a journalist, as a hack myself, partly seeing a moment, a sort of dawn of excitement as much as of change, you know, a sort of feeling that amidst all the dark undertow of some of those changes, there was a genuine concentrated confidence. The adrenaline rush, I suppose, of those early days. I mean, did it strike you as being actually rather an attractive world for all its obvious flaws?
Yeah, no, totally. And I wanted to protect the play from being too romantic or too nostalgic about a time gone by, because I don't think that's ever particularly helpful. But yeah, there was I was really seduced by the. I think I'm always really attracted to self-contained worlds, whether that's a constituency office or whether that's Westminster. And there was something about the community feel of Fleet Street, which I think surprises people today. But of course, every single newspaper lined that street, and all the journalists went to the same bars, pubs, cafes. They sometimes washed there in the spa. They got married there in the church. They had funerals there when colleagues died. This self-enclosed community, I thought, God, that it feels like the Wild West, and I really wanted to get in there and understand it. In terms of an age when I totally agree with you. I mean, when you think that the Mirror at the time was selling nearly 5 million copies, to have that many people engaging in print media is extraordinary. Now, obviously, that is dying, but I think this for me the most attractive thing was understanding this man Murdoch, who. You know, 40 years later, still has such a huge influence over our national conversation. And I know at the end of the election this year, there was much talk about the death of that influence and how, despite the power of the Daily Mail and of the Sun and the more conservative tabloids trying to character assassinate Jeremy Corbyn and them not succeeding, I still think the call that their influence is gone is not true, and I think you only have to look at the access that Rupert Murdoch has to President Trump, and how Fox News is driving the conversation in politics in America, that I think any suggestion that influence is waning is slightly complacent at the moment.
I was really struck rereading the play, just one of the many lines, I suppose, that Murdoch is put into Murdoch's mouth early on. When he talks about what he wants to achieve on Fleet Street, and he talks about it basically, I suppose, in proto-Thatcherite terms. He says, this street won't ever move forward while we think of it as a street rather than individual houses competing with one another, pushing each other forward in a fight for change, progress, the next big thing. So in the intoxication of that reverie, that vision, I suppose, there lies the sort of seeds of, you know, the Thatcherite model, and it galvanised, you know, as Murdoch came in to galvanise Fleet Street, in a sense, you know, 10 years later, that happened in politics. I mean, do you think that's, in some ways, is this a play about the dawn of Thatcherism as well for you, or is it in a sense that just a sort of side conversation? I don't know, because it feels as though it's very instrumental in articulating the play, articulates entrepreneurialism as the new thing. You know, it's going to be sexy and it's going to shake up the old establishment.
I think that's right. I think I was. For whatever reason, post-war British history really excites me, and I love telling the ideological story of how we moved from a consensus at the end of the war towards a more individualistic society under Margaret Thatcher, and then beyond that. So yes, I think you're right. One of the things we worked on a lot in the play was communicating this, the theme, I guess, of the shift from a more collectivist, community-based world to a more individual society, and Murdoch reflects that change. And actually, the story that we don't quite get to tell, but I hope we set up in the play, is what happens to the trade unions on Fleet Street and their incredible power in the 1960s. And then, you know, 20 years later, as Murdoch moved the Sun out of Fleet Street into Wapping, and the destruction of that trade union movement that would then lead to the miners' strike, that would then lead to things that go beyond that, and the radical transformation of British society. I think absolutely that's a theme in the play that we wanted to set up.
What's interesting about Ink is that it allows sympathy for the devil, the so-called devil. I mean, was there a feeling in you that you had to overcome a certain residual fury or disgust or something in order just to get this play out? Because I suppose some people on the left would just say this is giving advertising space to a man we've spent our last, half our lives fighting against. Was there a tussle for you to?
Of course, there was a huge tussle. I remember the first time I started writing lines to put in his mouth. It felt uncomfortable. I was nervous about this one. This one felt dangerous to me. I don't know why. Not just because of who that man is and his power and whether he would come and shut the show down, but also for me personally on a moral level. But I fundamentally believe the best way to hold people to account or institutions to account isn't just to throw vegetables at them and attack them, and certainly not to misrepresent them. I think the best way to hold people to account is to try and understand them and understand their motivations. And I think whether that's what any writer has to do with any character that you write, whether they're fictional or based on someone real, you have to understand their motivations and what drives them. I suppose also there was a sort of sadistic pleasure that I had in knowing that in showing him as a younger man, in showing him as a self-styled outsider or a radical or someone who was fighting against a system that was also pretty corrupt and also pretty unattractive, that people might find themselves very briefly, surprisingly, on his side. And I didn't mind that. I don't mind that at all, because I think then once you unlock that psychological block an audience might have, then you can take them on a journey. Then we can all go on a journey to understanding why this shift happened and what the impact was on people. And I hope and believe that by the end of the play, that we do go full circle, and we sort of by understanding the driving motivation behind what happened at the Sun and what the Sun is meant to be for and why people buy that newspaper, the audience sort of becomes more complicit in that. They understand it because they briefly, surprisingly, found themselves on their side championing them. And then I think we can ask those questions in a more effective way. So for me, it was never about putting him in the stocks and just attacking him. It was about understanding him.
Mm. What was the feedback from Murdoch Central? Did you get anything official?
We haven't yet. Well, no, we got the Sun guys came and watched it. Tony Gallagher, the editor, came and watched it, and he helped me. And I was grateful for that help. And I think they liked it. I saw pictures of Rebecca Brooks going in. I've got no idea what she thought. Joey Hall, I know, because came to see it, and apparently she thought it was okay. So I don't know.
But you've not had the final big word from the chief.
Not yet. I don't even know if he's seen it. I don't know if he wants to come and see it. I don't know what that would do if he did see it, and what that would do to the audience or the company. But for me, one of the joys of writing Ink, and one of the joys of working on this show, was the characters we don't know or who aren't familiar, and Larry Lamb, the first editor of the newspaper. Really, he's the driving narrative force behind the play, and he's played by Richard Coyle in the show, and he's just the most wonderful actor. But he's the guy that history has forgotten. But he's the guy who in a way, this will sound crude, but I took the Star Wars model of Darth Vader and the Emperor, and in this version, Murdoch is the Emperor, and Larry Lamb is the student learning the dark arts. And Larry Lamb is to go back to your previous point about the journey from collectivism to individualism. Larry Lamb was a working class lad from the north. He found his journalistic skills by going through trade unions and writing in trade union magazines. And the journey he goes on is the journey that Britain goes on. And by the end of the play, or at least by the end of his editorship of The Sun, he'd come full circle from being on the left, a Labour man, to being a Conservative and a believer in individual rights and rampant consumerism. And so his journey is Britain's journey, and he was always going to be an exciting character to write, I think. Mm. I don't think I consciously project onto them a uniform theme. You just can't help but, when you're writing them, channel into them the anxieties or the things that concern you at the time. So I look back now at Ink, Labour of Love and Quiz, and I notice similar obsessions in all three, whether that's a fear about the power of populism, how institutions and their control over us, whether that be broadcast media or whether that be print journalism or political parties. But with Quiz, what excited me was, again, taking a surprising story and putting onto it the political and social anxieties of the day. And for me, questions of truth and post-truth and alternative facts and mass media distortions and how our perceptions are shifting or being shifted by technology and by media is absolutely one of the most critical and crucial questions of the age. And weirdly, the story of the coughing major and him cheating on a game show, I saw in that a potential vessel to channel some of those ideas, because I do think something during the lifespan of this game show, I do think something shifted in our politics, becoming more using the weapons and the tools of light entertainment to sell us ideas, or the way that justice and entertainment merged, or the way that news and entertainment is being merged. So taking this trial of Charles Ingram and his wife and his alleged co-conspirator, that trial was extraordinary. It was an example of justice and entertainment merging with and you know, politics and performance, and so all those things, I think, yes, I hope are part of a play, which is also, of course, meant to be a fun romp about quizzes and pub quizzes and light entertainment.
It did strike me as actually almost the perfect Brexit play, because it's not about Brexit, but it is about Brexit. It felt as though, I know obviously Mike Bartlett's play, Albion alluded to, that was an allegorical really approach, but here in some form of almost like a art house kind of conceptual object, Quiz, it seemed to me, in asking us to make a decision on the basis of a certain amount of information, and then throwing us slightly with another set of, you know, evidential bits and bobs, you know, made me sort of sheepishly walk away thinking, how on earth did I make a decision about the referendum?
Right. Okay.
I don't know how much that just cropped up inadvertently, or how much you felt that was one way of talking about mass decision making.
Totally. No, that's absolutely the driving desire. One of the my obsessions at the time was exactly that. What informs the decisions we make? And so in Quiz, the audience has many roles. It's both the jurors in a court case, but they're also contestants in a quiz show. They're also voters in a democracy. And I think you're exactly right. We ask the audience to basically take a 50-50, a referendum choice, guilty or innocent, when it comes to these characters. And then, I guess, through the course of the play itself aims to be a manipulation of their perceptions of truth and reality, and how that can shift their decision making. And every single night of the play, we have one vote towards the beginning and one vote towards the end. And generally speaking, those votes have always shifted. And that's really exciting to me. It's really exciting that the play itself is meant to be a deliberate form of manipulation of mass perception in the audience. So now I'm glad you feel that's inherent in the play
too.
So the quiz model, the interactive model, was always going to be, I think, the format. I guess in a similar way to privacy, that it became very early on, when I was writing privacy, that the form emerged that we were going to ask the audience to invade their own privacy and share some of their personal information with us. And that form felt like the best way to explore the political theme. So even though I think I worry sometimes on paper, these things look like gimmicks in a way, these interactive styles or these ways of presenting the ideas. For me, it's always finding the best vehicle, the best language, theatrical language, to examining the themes of the show. Similarly, I guess, with Labour of Love, the form emerged quite quickly for me of going backwards in time and then going forwards in time, because what I wanted, again, was to talk about perception and how the view of something one way can then be completely altered when you show it backwards in reverse. And is that a way of unlocking the problems of the Labour Party in terms of us refusing to see certain things in a certain direction, and us being put in these factions whereby both sides aren't talking to each other? So yes, even though some of these plays might feel quite traditional, I hope that in there somewhere, in the form and the style of presentation, is that the form itself is asking a political question.
we don't have any real scope to go into the psychiatrist's chair, nor would I want to propel you into it. But I suppose I'm just partly interested, I suppose, in your perception of your own, this even-handedness and this sort of, it's a refusal to be partisan about your subject matter. And, you know, I can't help but observe that your parents were divorced when you were quite young.
Yeah.
You're also a twin. And I suppose this idea of seeing things from both sides, of sort of wrestling with polarities, which I guess would happen to anyone who's had those, has that as a sort of basic psychological makeup, whether that is, goes some way to explaining a little bit your being kind of pivoted in the centre of things. You know, you do seem to sort of wrestle with opposites. And I wonder whether that's something that you have detected in yourself as being part of your natural temperament, or whether it's something that actually, in some ways, you can't ascribe to any of that. It's just your political persuasion, I suppose.
I suppose the only thing I can fall back on for that is I was, always accused growing up by my family as being the diplomatic one. I don't always think as a compliment, but I think sometimes people thought I would always sit on the fence or not take a side. But I observed, or at least looking back at growing up, and even, you know, in recent events in my family's life, I've observed that to be the diplomatic one, or to be the one who is trying to bring sides together, has befallen me my natural role, whether that's because that's my natural temperament, or whether because no one else was doing it and I thought someone had to step forward. I don't know, but I maybe in there somewhere is a desire to bring opposites together, or to at least try and make people see the other side's argument. I guess also, and I know I've said this before, but I guess also something about my part of the world, Nottinghamshire. It was a strange place politically to grow up in during the closing of the mines, and it's got this weird identity crisis, North Nottinghamshire. It feels northern, it feels Yorkshire, but it's not, it's in the Midlands. And there was a literal split in the miners' strike between two sides, where a lot of miners in my town went back to work and formed a different union from the striking miners. And those tensions and that rupture continues to this day. And so I suppose politically, you know, the difference between the left and the right, striking and not striking, Labour, Conservative, those divides were never these huge chasms as I think they were elsewhere. They were always overlapping and they were always close. And I saw the potential violence, and the literal violence actually, and even death in some circumstances, of two sides not being able to meet and to talk or to understand each other. And there's something in that that always makes me very angry and makes me very nervous about why we can't, as human beings or as a community or as a culture, meet and talk and engage and understand and tolerate. So maybe it's that as well.
Yes, so I don't necessarily probe too hard, but so when you talk about death, I mean, you're saying you witnessed as a child people being dying as a result of...
Not even as a child, actually. There was one of the worst events that happened in my town was about 10 years ago, so I was 20, 22, 23. And the on my uncle's street, around the corner from my street, even 20 years after the strike, a striking miner murdered... which way around was it? Forgive me. Yes, a miner who went back to work, went onto the house of a miner who didn't go back to work and shot him in the face. And this was the effect that had, I remember, on my family, my community was huge, because it reignited something that felt like it had been at least ignored or buried or suppressed for a while. And yeah, of course I sit there thinking, I can't imagine what on earth would drive two people to be so apart on a political issue that would lead to death and would lead to murder.
Looking ahead at your next play, which is about Hull, and it's all pivoted around what's happened or hasn't happened at this year's City of Culture celebrations there. But what is it that's driven you to write about the City of Culture?
Well, first and fundamentally, just because that's where I learned about culture, that's where I went to university, I had a great time at Hull University learning about drama. It's the Hull Chuck Theatre is the place I saw most of my first ever pieces of new writing. So there's that personal draw back to the city where I felt had a huge impact on my life. But no, I also see, well, partly again, it's about processes and systems and institutions. I was really fascinated by how you organise something like this, a city of culture, and the coming together of all those local institutions, the local council with producers, with artists, with a funding body, and how art mixes with traffic flow and street lamps and paving slabs. But also, I want to ask a question: can culture change a city? Can it change a city's perception of itself, its confidence and its belief in itself? And without sounding like I've drank the Kool-Aid, Hull has changed. It's changed beyond recognition in all the ways it can change people's perception, people's belief, their well-being, their happiness, their mental health, I think has really improved, and it's measurable. So what I got really excited about was there is a unit in the City of Culture organising team who are trying to measure the impact of art, theatre, dancing, acting on people's health and happiness. And it's possible. So there are graphs and there are algorithms and there is data to support how it's improved people's lives, or in some cases not, and where the work to be done there is. So yes, it might feel like a self-indulgence, but it's a play that tries to examine can culture be measurably affect and change a city's fortunes. Okay. It's a bit to be on A in 2012. It's taking the piss out. It's a city of culture play that takes the piss out of the very people that commissioned me to write it, but it does it affectionately in that kind of whole sense of humour.
And given that we expect you to write at least a play a week at the moment, I mean, I know you are the definition, I suppose, of prolific in a good way. And I mean, that's presumably something that's must be quite heartening. I mean, I suppose one final question was, you know, looking back at your work on the Fringe in the noughties, I mean, it seems as though actually we as an audience have come closer to you rather than the other way around, because it feels as though a lot of the work, when you were looking at Anthony Eden or Margaret Thatcher, the 70s particularly, you know, has become relevant to us now. Those discussions in those plays feel pertinent. And yet, of course, then you were playing to 60 people or whatever, yeah, at the Finborough, and now, of course, you've got a sort of West End platform. I mean, I don't know whether you feel that you've tightened up as a writer, and that's how we explain your preeminence, or whether in a way the post-crash, the public has changed, do you feel, in terms of its hunger and appetite for work that tries to confront these forbidding subject matter?
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer. I just remember in those early years, how many years, 11, 12 years ago, when I first started at the Finborough Theatre, and I felt so lucky to be there, because I was 20, 21 when my first play went on there, I think, about Albert Einstein, called Albert's Boy. And I felt like I found a home, because I didn't think at the time, and this is no criticism of other new writing venues in London, but that what new writing was, or at least what people thought younger writers should be writing, wasn't those kinds of plays. They weren't political histories. And with Neil McPherson and the Finborough Theatre, I found a home to do something that at the time I think was deeply unfashionable, and that people didn't think there was an audience for plays about Margaret Thatcher or the Suez Canal crisis. And for now, whatever reason there is, and I don't take credit for that at all. I just think you're right. I think an audience's hunger for politically engaged work, whether that be TV drama, whether that be films, whether that be theatre, is there, and it contradicts the expectations, because people think and assume that actually the last thing people want to do at the moment after a day's work is go and engage with a crisis in the Labour Party or a corrupt media. But they do. I think they want to gather together and they want to ask these questions, and also, God forbid, they also sometimes want to be entertained as well, and I think that's my responsibility.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, to find hundreds of recordings with some of the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was hosted by Dominic Cavendish and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum. Thanks for listening.